This is one of those places in the book, the stuff we're going to talk about today, where there's a lot of explanatory text. I think it's worthwhile reading if you haven't been reading to read these sections we're talking through in the next couple lectures. Okay. So we're talking about constrained equations. Let's say we have n generalized coordinates. And we're going to call them using I or J. KJ, QJ. You'll often see that as an I instead of a J, but we'll use J to match the book. So we have n generalized coordinates describing our system. Right. We can write a configuration constraint. And basically we're saying that, hey, there's some configuration constraint. There's some function of our generalized coordinates and time that equals 0. Right? And we could have more than one of these. So that's what the subscript here is. These are configuration constraints. They're a function of the generalized coordinates themselves, of the configuration. Okay. So that name pretty much explains what they do. They constrain the kind of kinematically admissible positions, if you will, of a system. Okay. We can also do, of course, we can also have constraints on velocity. Okay. And these, of course, both of these could be kind of in terms of linear generalized coordinates or rotational. Okay. So let me write up this general form of this velocity constraint, which I never exactly remember what it looks like. Change that. Equals 0. So in the book, you'll see this also written Qn, and we'll leave what that is shorthand for is Q1 Qnt. So it's a function of all, possibly a function of all n generalized coordinates. So you'll see, folks, you know, write that as a J there, or as your book is doing in this series of equations, writing N. It's kind of, again, shorthand for, hey, it's all my generalized coordinates there. Okay. What we'll see between these two different types of constraints is that quite often it's easier to define velocity constraints for a system than it is to define configuration constraints. And often we'll see these velocity constraints written in a slightly different form, where we have the, make sure I get the, talk about those terms in just a second. And what we'll see is this is actually even a special form. This is what we would call a It's a velocity constraint. That's a linear equation, right? So linear not meaning in a line, linear meaning mathematically linear. So, let's kind of talk through these, and we'll talk through their relationship after we kind of review what we kind of mean by the two. Configuration constraint. Basically, it tells us, it gives us an expression that represents how the system arrived or could arrive at its current state. So, where it's at right now, its configuration, right? Or its configuration over time was an allowed configuration, kinematically admissible. Right. The velocity constraints, you can think about them as given its current configuration, what direction can it move in? More or less. Right. So if I have a velocity constraint, given my current configuration, I have a velocity constraint, I can move that direction. Well, my next set of generalized coordinates has to be in that direction. So in some ways, the velocity constraint defines what direction you can move at as much as it defines kind of min or maximum velocity in those kind of things. And in fact, min or max velocities don't generally fit this form anyway. They're nonlinear constraints. So these velocity constraints, again, largely define the direct, given your current configuration, set of generalized coordinates, where you're at in space right now, which direction can I move? Or which directions can I move? Or what direction can't I move, I guess, more specifically. Okay. I can also take this equation and put it in what's called the, I'm not going to spell this right, Pfaffian form with a P out front. Is it two Fs? Yes. Oh, I got my order of Fs all mixed up. One F out front. Basically, I'm going to take this entire equation and multiply by dt. So, aij. So this is dqj over dt. So I just end up with dqj. So this is the Pfaffian form of that velocity constraint. And again, the text of the book has some explanation of where this name comes from and such. Okay. So, like we were talking here, this kind of just restricts the direction that your system can move. You can think, well, this one, because of the Pfaffian form, we can look at that. This defines kind of how can the system move over some really small interval dt. There's another way to kind of think about what direction am I allowed to move. And here is, well, how can I move over some really small interval? Which is kind of giving you a direction that you can move in. That guy's an I. There's J here. Because you can have n different constraint equations, right? So that's what the I is there for. Right? This can be a set of constraint equations. This can be a set of different.
That's because you said the previous ones,
I wasn't sure if it was. Yeah, I there. Yeah, I there. These are I. Yeah, this guy's an I. Okay. You can have I different constraints, or you could have m different constraints. I the subscript I, either on F or A and B is the ith one of those m different constraints.
I think he was asking whether the sigma index changes.
Oh. No. Does not. Okay. So why do we care about this Pfaffian form? Well, it gives us some insight into
whether the constraint polynomic is holonomic or non-holonomic. We could also write, just so you know, and we're going to use the terms here, the Pfaffian form of this guy. Okay, so just same thing, multiply by dt, you're going to put the dqj there, and a dt out the back, that guy. Okay. And what we're going to look at is, we need the velocity constraint to differ only from the Pfaffian form of the configuration constraint, which we could do this way, by some integrating factor. Okay. So let me write out those equations. So this is going to be a G. GI. Function of QN and T. AIJ. Also QN and T. We want that to be J-I-T. Yes. And we have that should be P-I. So basically, we took this configuration constraint, and we kind of took its derivative. We could take the velocity constraint, put it in Pfaffian form. If those things are equal, only differing by this integration factor. Right? If this if these equations those equations are satisfied for every generalized coordinate in your system, the constraint is holonomic. Let me change that to if and only if. So this is true. Right. You can make this work for a set of for a velocity constraint. Right. Then that constraint is holonomic. And holonomic here is the Greek for integration. Right. So we can integrate the velocity constraint and get a configuration constraint out of it. That's effectively what this is saying, kind of physically. Okay. And as you might expect, if that's not true, then the constraint is non-holonomic. So that's kind of the mathematical definition of holonomic and non-holonomic. We'll get to over the next, later today, and then probably examples on Thursday to look at kind of what does it mean physically for there to be a non-holonomic constraint. Okay, I'm going to put on a few other things here. These terms here. So we can look the those terms in that guy, right? They define terms inside we're gonna call whole number of constraints. So we can look at these, you know, if you kind of look at this equation, well, that can give us some aij terms that can form that can allow us to write our constraint in a kind of matrix form. This is called the Jacobian constraint matrix. And we can do this, and it's called this even if the constraints are not holonomic. So this equation holds for all j if it's holonomic, but we still can form these aijs. Right? If it's not holonomic, we can form this Jacobian constraint matrix. Okay. You're probably looking at this and saying, well, how do I actually determine that's true, right? And it turns out that's a good question because it's often not very easy to do that, particularly as your system grows, right? So determining in general if a constraint is holonomic or non-holonomic can be non-trivial. So it's quite often what we will do is if we have velocity constraints, we will just treat them as if they're non-holonomic. Velocity constraints that are not immediately obvious as being holonomic, which those do exist. Right? So if any questions whether it's a holonomic or non-holonomic velocity constraint, we'll just treat it like it's not holonomic, rather than trying to go through this process and prove which one it is. Right, we'll see how that shakes out over the next few lectures as well. Yes, and it's for kind of that reason, yeah, right? The configuration constraints will also often require us to know the motion of the system, but that's also often what we're trying to figure out.
Right.
So there's kind of that, like this, we know what direction it can move, we don't know necessarily what configuration it's going to take. Where you have to know the configuration to know whether that's satisfied or not.
And you're saying if it is holonomic, then we can figure out the configuration constraint from
the velocity constraint, that's right. Exactly right. Okay. When we talk about treating all these guys as, or treating a velocity constraint that you think might be non-holonomic, that becomes important because that dictates how many generalized coordinates you're going to need to use. Okay. So if we look at this, I'm going to use the middle here since it's related to everything we have up there already. So let's define a few things. Let's say J of C, it'll be that Jacobian stuff. Constraints. We're gonna say. Freedom. So we have JC is the number of configuration constraints. We're going to have JV, number of non-holonomic constraints. We don't have holonomic constraints there because they can be written as configuration constraints. So it would fall into the first case. And then D is the number of degrees of freedom. In general, we're going to need generalized coordinates. And number of generalized coordinates we're going to need to describe the system Well, if you look at that, these configuration constraints, by any kind of definition, if I've picked my generalized coordinates in the right way, which we've talked a lot about throughout the beginning part of the semester, I can get rid of those generalized coordinates, right, if I pick the right set. Right, so last week we had the, you know, we had the bar that looked like this or whatever, and we could pick, you know, we could pick the center and an angle, and we'll give us the location. We could pick x, y there, x2, y2, right, as a set of generalized coordinates. Well, these are going to need some configuration constraints. Right. But I can get rid of those configuration constraints by picking x, y, theta instead. Right. So generally, we can get rid of, let me do that, not quite red, because it's optional. We can usually get rid of those configuration constraints by being smart about how we pick our generalized coordinates that we're going to use to describe the system. But you see, hey, these non-whole note constraints, we're not going to be able to get rid of those. Right, so we're going to tack on extra variables we're going to have to carry over in our solution procedure. Questions so far?
Is there an example of, with a wise choice, that you can't get rid of those? Like a simple example?
Where you can't get rid of them, no, you should be, strictly speaking, be able to always get rid of them. You may want to still include them if you care about, and depending on the system, you might want to express it in this way for some other reason. All right, so you always have the option of including them always. Right, but you don't have to, right? We could write a set of generalized coordinates that are x1, y1, x2, y2, x, y, and theta. That's a full set of generalized coordinates. We're just going to have a lot of constraints that relate and enforce the relationship between those. So that's always an option. Use as many variables as you want. It's just going to be a bit messier and extra work for you, generally, which I think we like to avoid when we can. Other questions before we look kind of examples? We'll get to. Okay, so let's look at kind of the kind of common example or type of system where we might have non-holonomic constraints. Kind of think about what they mean physically. So we might have, let's do, see if I can draw this guy. Something like this. Maybe. I guess there's some pad in the back too, huh? So this is meant to be an ice skate. This could very equally be a boat. Sorry, they want to be using a boat. Could be a car. Okay. So if you think about an ice skate, and we're going to look at kind of curved blade, actually perfectly only contacts in one point P. And we can define some frames maybe relative to this guy. And then maybe there's some angle. Where those guys are supposed to be parallel. Okay. Well, if you have this kind of perfect ice skate, what direction can it actually move in from this configuration? Yeah, it can really only go this way, right? I mean, it can slide, obviously, but if we're an ideal slide, ice skate and no sideways slipping, hey, it really only can have velocity in that direction. Or you have a boat. You know, a boat can slip sideways, but quite often we would model it this way, where we don't boat. Sorry, keep doing that. A boat, you know, particularly, especially, you know, we would model a car this way for sure. We don't often include the side slip in general car navigation. Boats we can, depending on what we're trying to look at. So we have this velocity constraint, right? And that velocity constraint is kind of independent of its configuration, right? The configuration might set the direction that it's in, but relative to the body fixed skate coordinates, it's always in that same direction. And it's not dependent upon what configuration it took us to get to that current one. How many degrees of freedom does the system have? We have a rigid body and a plane, effectively.
Just one. Because we're assuming that we're not sliding back and forth.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe this way, then it's just moving.
So it's moving. Yeah, moving in two directions, and I have an angle. It's a rigid body in the plane. I have 3 degrees of freedom. All right. And maybe kind of that's the obvious choice, maybe for generalized coordinates then, x, y, and theta. Okay. Well, we know that, hey, that we also have a constraint, though, on the velocity. Right? Subscript, yes. P. Plus, yes. We know that has to hold. So its velocity, according to theta, the x component has to go velocity in this direction, y component has to equal the velocity in that direction. So you have 2 degrees of freedom and then 1 constraint. Okay. In particular, we have 1 constraint that, hey, it's a velocity constraint. It's not immediately obvious that we can back out a configuration constraint from that, so we're going to treat it as a non-holonomic constraint then. I guess that's why theta. The other constraints, and we'll see that that kind of also applies here. All right. So we know that then x that has to be true. We know that this has to be true. So that's actually, in some ways, two different velocity constraints, right? We can know then that to be true, we can sub P there. Relationship between our generalized coordinates that's defined by our velocity constraint. We could also take this guy and write it in the form that more closely matches what we saw in the previous board, if you will. So if we do that, we can do multiplying by cosine theta on both sides. And then, well, that tells me that so I have a constraint in the kind of form that we wrote them on the previous board. A kind of standard velocity constraint form, if you will. We could have also taken, let's kind of play around with this constraint a little bit more. Write the Phaethian form of that constraint. And if we take, let's do this one instead. So if I multiply this guy by dt, so let's write out so I take the constraint, multiply the whole thing by tt. I have the Phaethian form of that constraint, which is essentially, in this case, relating small changes in the position of x and y. And this kind of restricts, based on that relationship, restricts what the next admissible, what the admissible positions of YP are for each instant in time. So we can kind of see the different ways to view the function of a velocity constraint on a system. Right, kind of, again, it is kind of restricting what direction I can move or how the generalized coordinates can progress through time. Questions about constraints. We'll talk more about those over the next few days. But just kind of getting the high-level stuff out there. Okay, good time. All right, so this. Section 7.2.3 of your book talks about configuration space for systems and gives a kind of introduction to variational methods, which is an entire other class or two of its own for solving dynamics problems or solving optimization problems. It's a pretty powerful method. So given that it's an entire other class of its own, we're just going to pass by. But probably take a look at that section. I think it's one to be aware of. Right. I think we haven't offered a variational methods class to my knowledge here, in my time here at least. Hopefully that changes soon, because it is something useful to know about. So, again, please read, be aware of that at least. So, we're going to move on and talk about evaluating virtual displacements. So how do I... Makes sense that it's a new section. Okay. We also are going to skip past 7.3.1, which talks about an analytical method for determining virtual displacements, so kind of a, in some ways, a derivation of how to get to those virtual displacements. We're going to use the kinematical method.
7.3.2. And basically what this method boils down to is writing the velocity of a particular point and then using that to determine what the virtual displacement of that point is. So we can write, say if we're looking for the virtual displacement of point A, and we can write, we know that that is true. Right. We can write this derivative in terms of our generalized coordinates, where we have n of them. T. J. There's a dot. Yep. General derivative of that expression. Okay. We can take this whole guy. Multiply by dt if we want. Get it. So I guess I should have brought this bracket all the way back over here. And that's also just partial, so we have a full time derivative still. Okay, so we're looking to get the virtual displacement. What we're looking for, to clarify, is the virtual displacement of point A. Right. So this is a kind of admissible displacement of point A over a really short time duration, dt. Right. Velocity times time equals displacement. So that's what we kind of calculated here, admissible time over dt. But we said, hey, these virtual displacements occur in zero time, so that dt is actually zero. Okay. So we can write what that gives us then if we do that, is that virtual displacement. That's virtual QR. So, a little bit of math, which I think you're going to forget about, because the core of this method really is to prescribe the velocity of the point, and then take all the velocity terms in that point and replace them with virtual displacement. So we'll do that right now. Okay. Fit here, I think. Example 7.5. Time, yeah, we put that. Example 7.5, we have sphere. Radius R2. Another circle. Center there. This little guy is R1. There's a point here. Oh, that's theta.
other one is phi. That guy is P. Okay. This there's no slipping between those guys as that cylinder, or as the disc rolls along the larger circle. So, in other words, we have pure rolling, we would say there. We want the virtual displacement of point P. Okay. So where do you guys think we would start this problem? Choosing generalized coordinates. I think that's one way to get there. What else do we generally do to start out most problems? Pick some frames. Yeah. So I'm going to recommend a frame in this case that looks like this, that is fixed to the center of the disk, where X is in that direction. Yeah, fixed to the center of the disk as it rolls around. Y is always pointing out. And let's call the center of the disk, which is the origin of that frame, going to be C. Because we've said pure rolling, what do we know about this system?
Velocity of that contact point is zero.
Velocity of this guy is zero, yeah. What else do we know? Can we say anything about these arc lengths if we have pure rolling? So we have R2 phi, yep. What's the small one? R1 and theta. And what do we know about those two if we have pure rolling? Going to be the same, exactly right. So that gives us relationship between phi and theta. That's going to hold always. It's going to be true. Okay. What can we say about the velocity of point C? Plus R2 phi dot. Why is it that? What direction?
In the I or negative I. Right.
He's increased. How could you get there if you didn't see that? Well, let's define some angular velocity of that upper disk. So basically we're writing VC relative to this point. We know its velocity is zero. Like that. So So we're going to know from that. So we have minus R1 omega. That gives us something to write omega with. So we could pick this out from it being knowing it's in a circle around that center. Right. You can also think about this velocity, right? If this was just rolling on a flat ground and had that omega, what's its center point velocity going to be? So it's just radius times that angular velocity. So you can get to those two expressions by recognizing kind of the geometry of the situation. Right. That's going to give us omega. Right. We need this omega, the rotation rate, right? It's in direction k, we're saying, in order to be able to write that. Right, we're going to find the velocity of point P. Position of P relative to C. I will write sine theta I plus. Oh. That. But hey, well, I know that is actually this. So I can take, I have this VC term that I'm able to write in terms of phi dot. I know omega is so, I have an expression for the velocity of point P. Okay. Now, if I want to get what we're trying to get, again, is the virtual displacement of point P. Right. So, all I need to do then is take this expression, and you'd want to probably work it out, you know, do the cross product first. Right. Take the total time derivative terms of our coordinate, each of our generalized coordinates that show up in this equation. And replace them with virtual displacements of that coordinate. And when I do that, I have an expression for the virtual displacement of point P. So this is the kinematical method described in section 7.3.2. Basically, all boils down to writing the velocity of the point you're trying to get the virtual displacement of, taking the time derivatives, all the time derivatives of the generalized coordinates, replacing those with virtual displacements in that particular coordinate. Example 7.6 also does this and looks at it from the perspective of a couple different frames. That's probably a good problem, pretty good example for you to take a look at to understand this a little bit better. It's not making sense quite yet. Okay. Why we would be interested in the virtual displacement of a point? Because that's going to allow us to get to defining generalized forces that we're going to use in Lagrange's equation, which we are very rapidly sneaking up on, having all the information we need to form that equation. Okay, so look for an email from me in the next 24 hours that will set up the Jupyter Notebook for you to get done by Monday again. It's not meant to go bang your head against the wall to try to figure it out for the next week. If you're having any troubles, you know, try it, obviously, on your own. But if you're having troubles getting it working or don't know quite what to do, come see email or come see me. I'll be around.